Today is Thursday, April 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up...
I think one of the things we need to recognize as a global community is that COVID-19 anywhere is COVID-19 everywhere.
Plus, one immigrant community in New York City finds itself at the center of America's COVID-19 outbreak. And U.S. President Donald Trump wants to reopen America's economy, but health experts are concerned. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today, the COVID-19 coronavirus has claimed over 137,000 lives with more than 2 million people infected worldwide. The head of the World Health Organization's European office said the European region is facing about 50% of the global burden of COVID-19. Dr. Hans Kluge said Europe's COVID-19 cases doubled to nearly 1 million over the last 10 days, with rising numbers of new infections in the UK, Turkey, Ukraine, and Russia, despite declining numbers in France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Switzerland. In Britain, the government is set to extend a nationwide lockdown for several more weeks, as health officials say the coronavirus outbreak in the country is peaking. Health Secretary Matt Hancock said it is too early to make a change to the lockdown, which began March 23rd. Over 12,000 people have died in UK hospitals after testing positive for coronavirus, but that number does not include deaths in nursing homes and other settings. In Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on Thursday extended a state of emergency to cover the whole country to stem the spread of the disease. Abe had already declared a month-long state of emergency in 7 regions, including Tokyo, where a recent spike in cases has prompted warnings that emergency medical facilities could collapse. And the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, warned Thursday that coronavirus outbreaks across the Middle East threaten to shatter the lives of millions of already destitute people in conflict zones and could fuel socioeconomic upheaval. The group said authorities in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Gaza, Lebanon, and Jordan should prepare for a, quote, potentially devastating aftermath, end quote. The statement did not refer to Iran, which has the region's biggest outbreak with around 78,000 infections and over 4,800 deaths. But a spokeswoman said it was supporting the Iranian Red Crescent Society. For more on the worldwide response to COVID-19, VOA's Lenore Madu spoke to philanthropist Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, about what must be done to help those most vulnerable to the pandemic and what can be done to prevent future outbreaks.
The world is seeing an unprecedented crisis with the global pandemic of the COVID-19 coronavirus. First of all, what are your thoughts on what we are seeing right now?
Well, we're still seeing it on the rise in so many places around the world. And I think one of the things we need to recognize as a global community is that COVID-19 anywhere is COVID-19 everywhere. And we're just starting to see the effects on the most vulnerable parts of the population. And I have to be honest, that's the thing that keeps me up at night.
So practically, how do we help vulnerable population, children, pregnant women, even refugees and others? What can we do in this case with COVID-19 to help them?
What do? We make sure, first of all, that they're fed. People need to be able to have a meal in every single day. They need to have food, because if you don't start there, if people don't have access to food, they have to go out and find food, bring food into their home. We know it's something we all need. So one of the most important things we can do right now, I feel, is tell people we need to put money into making sure that people actually have access to food. Then we have to make sure that women know, if they're pregnant, where can you go safely to still do your prenatal appointments? Where can you go to safely deliver that baby? Don't deliver at home. We have to help practically speaking, the primary health care system separate out the patients who come in who have COVID from, say, patients who come in and are pregnant. That is fundamental in terms of having the health care system still work and support women who are pregnant. So those are two very practical examples.
When we think about what's happening in 2015, your husband, Bill Gates, delivered a TED Talk where he really warned people of the greatest threat that was coming up, which will be an infectious virus, highly infectious virus. Now, what has the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation done in terms of encouraging the world to prepare?
Well, after that TED Talk that Bill did in 2015, we worked with the G7 and to really talk about the Ebola pandemic that had happened, and then to set up something called the Center for Epidemic Preparedness, it's called CEPI, to start to have a place where we could bring together the science of the world to prepare for an epidemic. Unfortunately, not very many leaders took up that rallying call. One of them who did, though, was Chancellor Merkel in Germany. She took it very seriously. And not much later, after she had led the G7, then we set up this CEPI organization. But to be honest, it was not well funded by governments around the world. And if it had been, we wouldn't be in such a terrible place right now in terms of understanding this disease and potentially having some more solutions.
So then today, what is the status with CEPI? Is there enough funding? Who is benefiting from these funds?
So we've seen a number of philanthropists step up and start to fund CEPI now. And the great thing that CEPI can do is it can start to bring in vaccine candidates and compounds and start to move those into preclinical trials and then full trials to eventually manufacture a vaccine. And so we're actually moving about 8 vaccine candidates forward, and that will begin the work so that we hopefully in less than 18 months have a vaccine.
And are we going to see a trend in the future? What do experts tell us in terms of this COVID-19 and what we should expect?
Well, I think we always need to be prepared as a world that there are going to be other infections coming, other viruses, and we have to plan for them. Just like we plan now for natural disasters, for an earthquake or for a fire, we actually have to run drills and scenarios of, okay, if we see disease outbreaks somewhere in the world, what do you do to immediately alert all governments, all centers for disease control, start to collect the right data by gender, by type of population, so the world can respond very quickly instead of in this more slow, sort of haphazard way that you're seeing this sort of patchwork quilt that's going on around the world?
That was Melinda Gates, philanthropist and co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, speaking to VOA's Lenore Madu. Continuing our COVID-19 coverage, the U.S. has the worst COVID-19 outbreak on Earth, with over 30,000 dead from over 600,000 cases. The epicenter of the U.S. outbreak is New York City, which has recorded over 110,000 cases and over 10,000 deaths. And within New York City, the hardest hit area is the borough of Queens, which is home to many immigrant groups. One of those groups is the Filipino American community, which has an outsized number of healthcare professionals, almost all of whom are at high risk of infection due to their jobs. To find out about one Filipino American's experience during this crisis, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Marilyn, who requested that her last name not be used. Marilyn is a second-generation Filipino-American and a proud Queens resident. Marilyn is a second-grade teacher who is now teaching her students remotely from a computer video conferencing app.
There's a large Filipino-American community here, and unfortunately, with this pandemic, Queens being an epicenter right now, it's been an interesting and scary time, to say the least.
I know your parents emigrated to Queens from the Philippines all the way back in the 70s, when there were far fewer Filipinos there. But now a large network of Filipino family and friends has grown up in the borough.
Luckily, there were a few neighbors there who were Filipino also, and that network grows over the years. So through the decades, the friends have become like family. And since this pandemic has hit us, it's been particularly hard for my mom and dad because a lot of their friends and people that, you know, you look to as aunties and uncles, unfortunately have passed away or fallen ill.
Can you tell us a bit about one of these losses?
I can give you one story of an aunt who passed away exactly a week ago. She was seemingly fine. She had been taking all the precautions. And unfortunately, because she lived in a house where there were a lot of other people, you know, nieces, siblings, and some of them still had to go to work, she caught the infection. So one day she went to the hospital alone. And from there, just things got worse. And that was the last time that her sister, whose house she lived in, saw her.
Filipino Americans tend to be quite religious, with wakes and special prayers, etc., and funerals. But the normal funeral rituals have been suspended during this time.
Right now, it's pretty hard because you can't hold a proper funeral. You can't do the normal wake and the services that, you know, you want to in order to say goodbye. You have to contact a funeral home to pick up the body. They do the burial. And then if you're lucky, you get to go to the cemetery just to see the tombstone. I know for my mom, that's been very hard because usually you're there to help out affected families. You bring them food. You know, you're there for them. So yeah, she's been pretty depressed.
How are you coping with all this?
Last week was really rough. After the third or fourth time that my mom, you know, told me somebody passed away, it's terrible, but it's kind of like you become numb to it.
I know a very high proportion of Filipino immigrants are in the health professions one way or another.
Yeah, both my sisters are nurses. My aunt is a nurse. My best friend, who I met in second grade, is a doctor, and she's going in every day. And she's the type of person who's very matter of fact. She doesn't really get emotional, but I think the second week of quarantine, she drew a picture about what work was like, and she kind of broke down and was sounding pretty panicked. She's a heart doctor, and she typically only dealt with certain cases, but every floor she's saying has been pretty much a COVID floor. And then, God forbid, you went in for something else, you're bound to get COVID because of just the situations. We know now there's not enough masks, gloves, gowns.
It must be really hard to know how to process all this when even your doctor friends, the stoic ones, are panicked, as you say.
I don't know how one processes all that information or all that loss. You can't ignore any one emotion or feeling or thought, but then you can't wallow in it either. And it's a hard juggling act. Being a teacher, you know, having to put on your teacher hat and be on these video calls and provide stability for, you know, your students who you care about as well. It's just been roller coaster of emotions.
That was Marilyn, a Filipino American teacher in New York City, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. U.S. President Donald Trump is expected to announce guidelines on Thursday to begin reopening America's economy. Some health experts are concerned that moving too quickly to ease coronavirus social distancing orders could be dangerous. International Edition's Lori London spoke to Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University, about the health concerns of opening back up without being ready.
Having the worldwide economy and the American economy shut down, suffering terrible job losses, that leads to trouble and problems too. We have more domestic violence. We have people can't put food on the table. The suicide rate probably will go up. So it's a serious issue, but I don't think it's responsible to set dates. President Trump has said variously Easter, Memorial Day, other dates. I don't think that's correct because it gives the impression that everybody will come out on a given date. And that's not how things are going to work, at least not if we're going to try and balance tamping down the epidemic and saving lives against restoring the economy and getting some freedom to move around. The way it will work, I think, is governors will decide when their state's ready to come out. We could get a quick test and ramp up testing, which the president has not done. He talks about testing, but we don't have it. But if we get a saliva test, and it looks like a couple of those are happening where you don't even need to draw blood, you just spit in a cup and get a pretty quick result as to whether you're infected. Plus, we know that there's blood tests for people who have been infected but didn't die, survived it, or had no symptoms, but probably built some immunity. Those are the people who can come out first. So I think what you'll see is a gradual, if you will, restoration of the economy, a gradual permission for people to come out, either because they are immune, they've survived the virus, had the virus, and it didn't kill them, or just large-scale testing where we test every other day and make sure that you don't become positive and infect others.
By now, if we don't have nearly enough tests, it doesn't seem like we'll ever really know for sure when someone leaves their house what their status is, when they could be potentially one person spreading it to who knows how many. There are other states where the governors have never shut down the whole state. How concerned are you that we could likely see a second wave that could be bad?
I think we will see a second wave. You know, going all the way back to the 1918 flu epidemic that killed many people in the United States, it wasn't the first wave that was bad, it was the second. People came out, thing looked over, and then they came back, and that virus swept back with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. I think we'll see some of that. The good news, however, is we're learning how to treat people better if they have to go to the hospital. So we've learned a lot. We should be better prepared with protective gear and non-exhausted personnel and ventilators and so forth. At one end of the spectrum, and we'll do better if the thing reappears. On the other hand, there is going to be some sort of a calculation, and I'm going to say each state, not the federal government, but the states will do it and say, we're going to accept this many deaths to get the economy back. And that's a brutal, terrible, awful equation, but I think we're going to see it. I obviously lean toward trying to minimize the deaths. It doesn't do us much good if we're trying to go to work and we have to pass by endless numbers of cemeteries. It won't be good for morale and people will be afraid and many people won't go back to work or just won't come out. But I do think we're going to see that trade-off at some point. And it won't be in May. It'll be July, something like that. And then we'll see what happens with the return of the virus. I don't think we'll have a vaccine by then, but maybe we'll start to see some things come out that might be treatments, and that would be good too.
Right. I read an article this week that said social distancing will need to continue through 2022.
I think to really handle the epidemic, if we have no treatments and no vaccines, and all we've got is social distancing, you might get dates like 2022, but we're not going to make it that far. In the United States, people wouldn't stay shut in that long.
Right.
And at some point, the devastation to the economy overwhelms the damage from the epidemic. An interesting thing about coming out, I think you're going to have an app that's a passport that says, I am not positive. I am positive. I have immunoresistance. I have antibodies. I can't get sick and I won't make you sick. And if you're not willing to carry that app or paper passport, you're not coming out. So there'll be an interesting debate, particularly in the American context where freedom and civil liberties are very important values, about being willing to carry information that the government or your business or your employer can use to verify that it's okay to come out. I think that's another debate that will be part of this.
That was Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University, speaking to my VOA International Edition colleague, Lori London. A countdown to a fourth election in Israel in more than a year of political deadlock began on Thursday after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and main rival Benny Gantz missed a deadline to form a government. Both men had pledged to join forces in a national emergency government to battle the coronavirus crisis, but they could not agree on terms for power sharing, with Netanyahu's corruption trial, due to open next month, looming over their talks. At least 32 ethnic Rohingya people died on a ship that drifted for weeks. They are believed to have sailed from Bangladesh on a voyage to Malaysia, but were turned away due to strict border controls imposed by Malaysia because of the coronavirus pandemic. One Coast Guard official says the boat had been out to sea for about 2 months. There were 396 starving survivors on the boat. As many as 1 million Rohingya people are living in cramped, squalid camps in southern Bangladesh, with the majority having crossed over from neighboring Myanmar to escape a brutal military crackdown in 2017 that UN officials termed a genocide. Thousands of Rohingya over the years have attempted to escape the camps by boarding crowded boats bound for either Malaysia or Thailand. South Korean President Moon Jae-in's ruling party won an absolute majority in parliamentary elections, a landslide victory propelled by successes in the country's efforts to contain the new coronavirus. The election was one of the first nationwide votes on Earth since the pandemic began. Authorities took stringent safety measures, disinfecting all 14,000 polling stations and requiring voters to wear masks, have their temperatures checked, use hand sanitizer and plastic gloves, and maintain a safe distance from others. About 2,800 coronavirus patients were allowed to vote by mail or in person using special booths, while more than 13,000 in self-quarantine cast their ballots after polls closed. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. More than a decade of Boko Haram militant attacks have displaced more than 2 million Nigerians in Nigeria's north, with hundreds of thousands living in internally displaced people's camps. Medical experts worry a lack of spacing and good sanitary conditions in the camps could promote an outbreak of coronavirus, which has so far infected more than 370 people in Nigeria and killed 10. Ifeok Etang reports from Jos, Nigeria.
16-year-old Samuel Adamu is sitting in an uncompleted classroom at the House of Rekab, an orphanage for displaced children in Jos, Nigeria. He's holding a weekly Bible study class along with 11 other children living at the home. Although he prefers to say little about it, Adamu himself has been an internally displaced person since 2014, when Boko Haram militants invaded his hometown of Gwoza in Borno State.
I have lost many things. I have killed my loved ones and many other people that I know.
The conflict in Nigeria's northeast forced more than 2 million people to flee their homes and 850,000 live in IDP camps. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, half of the camps are overcrowded. Speaking via Skype, Nigerian physician Dr. Enwongo Ime Campbell says residents of the camp are at high risk of getting infected by a huge range of illnesses, including coronavirus.
Conditions such as cholera, conditions such as tuberculosis, pneumonia. And if you put that in the context of the current pandemic in the world right now, which is the COVID-19, that would be a perfect breeding ground for this illness.
The charity Mercy Corps provides humanitarian aid to the IDP camps in Nigeria's northeast. Speaking via Skype, Maxwell Samaila, the agency program manager on humanitarian response, said improving sanitation in the camp is a challenge.
For us to ensure that people actually practice regular hand washing, we need to have hand washing stations and soap, you know, installed and distributed at every location, almost in all the strategic locations, including camps. So, and, you know, with the current, you know, funding, we may not be able to achieve that because already the funds have been earmarked for some other interventions.
Securing enough food for the camps during Nigeria's restrictions on movement and business is another challenge, Samuel Adamu says.
This thing will really affect us. The places, they are just locking down the places and we don't know when they will open the place again. So we'll need food items, foodstuffs, so that we'll be able to have food to eat, especially for this period of time.
Nigerian authorities say they are working with the United Nations and other partners to assist IDPs and are also working on providing ventilators, face masks, and personal protective equipment for medical staff in the camps. Ifeok Etang for VOA News, Jos, Nigeria.
That's going to do it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great evening.